Blog Talk Radio.
Corporate pirates of the Caribbean report seeks to
to widen tax-saving loopholes. I mean, this is the way it goes, folks. And, you know, it makes you absolutely sick, you know, to see this happening. And, you know,
this is by Kenneth Cannell.
A new report from the Institute on Policy Studies called Corporate Pirates of the Caribbean details how the CEOs who make up the group Fix the Debt, a group pushing for harsh austerity measures, are set up to make even higher profits off the policies they are pursuing in the names of balancing the budget. Fix the Debt's members are pushing for cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and earned social insurance benefits while seeking to widen tax haven loopholes by creating a territorial tax system that would earn them as much as $173 billion.
The report found that the 59 Fix the Debt member corporations held more than $544 billion in offshore profits at the end of 2012. Those profits, much of which are only counted as offshore because of tax loopholes, are not subject to U.S. corporate taxes unless they are brought back into the United States. The switch to a territorial system would allow the corporations to avoid paying taxes on most of those profits. The IPS argues that the Fix the Debt members are less interested in fixing the debt and more interest in padding their own profit margins and are willing to hurt American working families to do so. That's disgusting.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, the fact that we're allowing them to do it, you know, makes it absolutely sick. And you take a son of a bitch like Obama, you know, who's nothing more than a banker lackey, all right, then we got a problem here. Man, we got a serious problem. Union veterans lobby at Ohio State House for job opportunities for all vets. More than 20 union veterans and members representing each branch of the military, along with a group, Veterans Helping Veterans and Others, Inc., met near the Ohio State House today before heading out to meet with 10 senators to discuss gaining support for Senate Bill 13, the Veteran Opportunity Act, sponsored by Lou Gentile. You know, I have to agree. These guys have gone out and shot up the world and killed themselves and other people. You know, the best we can do for them is at least give them a job when they get back.
SB 13. Let me just see. Go back. SB 13.
Now, and these activists met with members urging them to vote it out of committee and pass it through the Senate so the House of Representatives can vote on it. This is amazing and, quite honestly, something we
need to see more of
in order to help our veterans, said State Rep. Teresa Fedor. I hope all of you will go back into your communities and organize eventually events locally as well. You are all natural leaders coming from our military and can lead the charge to make it easier for our veterans to receive employment for college credit they deserve. Better served in the U.S. Air Force and Ohio Air National Guard for 6.5 years.
Senator Gentile reintroduced the SB 13 with the intention that the 130th General Assembly will address the critical education and professional needs of Ohio's veterans. The legislation seeks to expand the educational and professional opportunities for Ohio's veterans by calling for a standardized system in awarding academic credit for veterans who have taken coursework or who have received specialized training while in the armed forces. And this is a quote. It is my intention that this legislation make every public higher education institution more accommodating to our state's returning veterans and their families. As particularly Appalachia struggles to add jobs, we must do everything in our power to ensure that our veterans are as competitive as possible when they return from the service.
I keep thinking of Fort Dan in Ohio, you know. Yeah, you know, they're great.
There's a list there. Let's go down. The Ohio Veterans Opportunity Act includes several key provisions. Developing a model for training counselors and academic advisors to ensure the needs of veterans are being met. Training at least one faculty member at each two-year or four-year university as a liaison for contacts for student veterans. providing the faculty members with sensitivity and awareness on various issues facing veterans, including military and training culture, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and others. Establishing a program that creates collaborative relationships between student veterans and alumni to help link veterans with prospective employers.
And also on Ann was Air Force veteran Delta pilot and union member Scott Wharton, who will be running for Congress against Steve Stivers in Ohio. We have to do everything we can to ensure our veterans have the opportunity for a quality life at home, and that means a good paying job that uses, in, you know, no guns and no and don't kill yourself. All right, and that's basically what's happening to veterans right now. 25% of the veterans coming back are shooting themselves because they don't have jobs and they're post-traumatic stress.
A lot of them are very sick.
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of like, help these guys, help them. You know, it's unbelievable. Now, you get sick trying to talk to them, talk about this stuff, but when you see it, but it's like, you know, God.
Well, here's something positive, at least in Connecticut. Let me read this.
Union made Father's Day. Don't you think they should union make something on Father's Day?
Mm-hmm. Let me just read something positive that happened in Connecticut.
Okay.
This is from Council 4. Court rules against Roland over Laylock. I don't know whether folks remember Roland, who was
our most corrupt governor we've had in a century.
Yeah. He was sent to a federal prison for a year for his corruption. After nearly a decade, the Second Circuit Court's opinion invalidating John Roland's layoff of nearly 3,000 state employees is a tremendous victory for the free speech rights of all Americans. In a ruling issued May 31st, the court held that when a governor punishes people because of the group to whom they belong, whether it's a union or a political party or religion, he or she violates our Constitution's most cherished provisions. This case is now being remanded to the district court to craft appropriate, equitable relief and to consider the case for damages against Roland. The Second Circuit Court's opinion shows that Roland's treatment of public service workers as the enemy is costly and destructive to the workers and the vital public services they provide and to every taxpayer, said Attorney Daniel E. Livingston, Chief Negotiator for the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition. Instead, it's a mutual respect for the law, for public service workers, and most importantly, for the public we all serve, which will move us forward toward a better future, Livingston added. Our country and state simply function better when top officials work with us and for working families instead of against them. The state's union coalition stood up for workers' rights and for quality public services. I'm proud to be part of that effort, said AFSCME Local 704 member Geneva Hitchcock, a plaintiff in the case who was illegally fired in 2003. Hitchcock was a secretary at the Bristol Department of Social Service, which Roland shuttered in 2003. She now works as a secretary for the Department of Health. When Roland closed the Bristol DSS office, it affected our clients, our community, and it affected workers like me, she said. The court's decision is a welcome reminder to the John Rowlands of Connecticut, the Scott Walkers of Wisconsin, and the Koch brothers of everywhere that in America it's just not the powerful, the rich, and the big corporations that have free speech rights.
You know, Lila and I fought this son of a bitch, John Roland, back 10 years ago. All right, when he was running for, in 2002, when he was running for president. governor. All right, and when we supported a guy named Nick Cole, for governor then. I was a campaign manager, and we ran across 160 states, 160 towns in Connecticut, all right, and we put him on television, and we promoted, and Ned Cole said Governor Roland was a corrupt SOB, and I quote him, son of Satan, and, just the worst of the worst. And you know what? Didn't matter what we said. Didn't matter what anybody said. Governor Roland was reelected by the Republicans in Connecticut, and he was later found as one of the most corrupt son of bitches ever, and was imprisoned for a year and a day, okay, in 2003, all right, a year after his election. And, you know, and this is something that, you know, continues. And we have corrupt people after corrupt people in government, in local, federal, and state governments. And, you know, it just continues, and it will never stop. But, you know, God willing, at least 10 years later, the union is deciding to say, oh, Roland was a prick. All right. Okay, letter carriers drives to collect 74 million pounds of food. Hey, those guys. The letter carriers of the annual food drive collected 74.3 million pounds of food and was second most successful in the program's 21 years. The food was used to restock food banks, pantries, and shelters around the country. And the total was an increase of 5% over last year. Was the highest in a decade. NALC President Frederick Rolando stressed the importance not only of the food drive, but of the broader service postal carriers provide to their communities in a statement. He said, "This demonstrates in clear fashion that the value of the unique postal network, which goes to 151 million addressees 6 days a week. It also shows the remarkable connection between letter carriers and the communities they serve, a bond that serves the nation well. The letter carriers see firsthand the need in the communities where we work, and we're honored to be able to help people in need by leading an effort that brings out the best in so many Americans." And, you know, I praise the postal worker. They're a rare breed. And the NALC effort in this large annual food drive in the United States and its year, it touches 10,000 cities and towns in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, and Guam. The drive was successful in part because of a diverse group of national partners, Feeding America, Campbell's Soup Company, AARP, Valpak, Direct Marketing Systems, Velasis, Red Plum, U.S. Postal Service, United Way Worldwide, AFL-CIO, Uncle Bob Self Storage, GLS Companies, Source Direct Plastics, and the Publix grocery store chain. Okay? The postal employees, union members, and civil volunteers, and family circus cartoonist Jeff Keane also assisted in the effort. He said, "We could not have accomplished this without the hardworking team of partners we have, and all committed to ending hunger in our country," said Pam Donato, NALC's Community Service Coordinator. "Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive never has been more important than in these times, and hunger is a growing problem, affecting about 50 million people around the country, including 17 million children and 9 million senior citizens. Pantry shelves filled up through winter and holiday generosity often are bare by late spring. And with most school meal programs suspended during summer months, millions of children must find alternative sources of nutrition. In recent natural disasters such as tornadoes in Oklahoma and Superstorm Sandy on the East Coast, were particularly tough on food supplies this year. The states that Oklahoma, Vermont, and New Jersey set food collection records in response. I'm proud of those states and proud of those people for helping out so much."
I have something from UTILS here. "Wealth inequality in America." I'm not sure whether this is as an audio or it's just a video.
There's a chart I saw recently that I can't get out of my head. A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States. This is what they said they thought it was. Dividing the country into five rough groups of the top, bottom, and middle three 20% groups, they asked people how they thought the wealth in this country was divided. Then he asked them what they thought was the ideal distribution. And 92%, that's at least 9 out of 10 of them, said it should be more like this. In other words, more equitable than they think it is. Now that fact is telling, admittedly, the notion that most Americans know that the system is already skewed unfairly. But what's most interesting to me is the reality compared to our perception. The ideal is as far removed from our perception of reality as the actual distribution is from what we think exists in this country. So ignore the ideal for a moment. Here's what we think it is again. And here is the actual distribution. Shockingly skewed. Not only do the bottom 20% and the next 20%, the bottom 40% of Americans barely have any of the wealth. I mean, it's hard to even see them on the chart. But the top 1% has more of the country's wealth than 9 out of 10 Americans believe the entire top 20% should have. Mind-blowing. But let's look at it another way, because I find this chart kind of difficult to wrap my head around. Instead, let's reduce the 311 million Americans to just a representative 100 people. Make it simple. Here they are: teachers, coaches, firefighters, construction workers, engineers, doctors, lawyers, some investment bankers, a CEO, maybe a celebrity or two. Now let's line them up according to their wealth. Poorest people on the left, wealthiest on the right, just a steady row of folks based on their net worth. We'll color code them like we did before based on which 20% quintile they fall into. Now, let's reduce the total wealth of the United States, which was roughly $54 trillion in 2009, to this symbolic pile of cash. And let's distribute it among our 100 Americans. Well, here's socialism, all the wealth of the country distributed equally. We all know that won't work. We need to encourage people to work and work hard to achieve that good old American dream and keep our country moving forward. So, here's that ideal we asked everyone about. Something like this curve. This isn't too bad. We've got some incentive, as the wealthiest folks are now about 10 to 20 times better off than the poorest Americans. But hey, even the poor folks aren't actually poor, since the poverty line has stayed almost entirely off the chart. We have a super healthy middle class with a smooth transition into wealth. And yes, Republicans and Democrats alike chose this curve. 9 out of 10 people, 92%, said this was a nice, ideal distribution of America's wealth. But let's move on. This is what people think America's wealth distribution actually looks like. Not as equitable, clearly, but for me, even this still looks pretty great. Yes, the poorest 20 to 30% are starting to suffer quite a lot compared to the ideal, and the middle class is certainly struggling more than they were, while the rich and wealthy are making roughly 100 times that of the poorest Americans and about 10 times that of the still healthy middle class. Sadly, this isn't even close to the reality. Here is the actual distribution of wealth in America. The poorest Americans don't even register. They're down to pocket change. And the middle class is barely distinguishable from the poor. In fact, even the rich between the top 10 and 20 percentile are worse off. Only the top 10% are better off. And how much better off? So much better off that the top 2 to 5% are actually off the chart at this scale. And the top 1%, this guy, well, his stack of money stretches 10 times higher than we can show. Here's his stack of cash, restacked, all by itself. This is the top 1% we've been hearing so much about. So much green in his pockets that I have to give him a whole new column of his own, because he won't fit on my chart. 1% of America has 40% of all the nation's wealth. The bottom 80%, 8 out of every 10 people, or 80 out of these 100, only has 7% between them. And this has only gotten worse in the last 20 to 30 years. While the richest 1% take home almost a quarter of the national income today, in 1976, they took home only 9%, meaning their share of income has nearly tripled in the last 30 years. The top 1% own half the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of these investments, which means they aren't investing. They're just scraping by. I'm sure many of these wealthy people have worked very hard for their money, but do you really believe that the CEO is working 380 times harder than his average employee? not his lowest paid employee, not the janitor, but the average earner in his company. The average worker needs to work more than a month to earn what the CEO makes in 1 hour. We certainly don't have to go all the way to socialism to find something that is fair for hardworking Americans. We don't even have to achieve what most of us consider might be ideal. All we need to do is wake up and realize that the reality in this country is not at all what we think it is.
Isn't that the truth?
All right, so that means kill all the bankers and the hedge fund guys. You know, put them in prison. Act, you know, take all their wealth and
distribute it.
And what is that? That's socialism. And maybe that's the way to go, because the only way you're going to get rid of these sons of bitches is by getting rid of them. Now, sorry, folks, you're not going to get rid of them by striking, you know. You're going to get rid of them by going after them, you know. You're going to get rid of them by, you know, implementing bills that attack the wealthiest, all right? You're going to get rid of them by going after your congressmen, going after your senators, going after your damn president, and saying, either get rid of them or we get rid of you, all right? And that's the way it goes. Sorry, folks. Gee, it's so hard to explain this to the average lunatic who doesn't understand what's happening to him. No, sorry, the average American doesn't have a clue, right, what's going on. And this makes me sick. Last Easter week debate in the special Senate election in Massachusetts shows a sharp contrast in the position of two candidates hoping to replace new Secretary of State John Kerry. Yeah, that would be a wonderful replacement. Democrat Ed Markey, who I support, and Gabriel Gomez, Republican, differ greatly in their rights of government workers. Markey gave a spirited defense of the collaborative bargaining rights of first responders and others who work for the U.S. Department of Labor. Let's listen to this. It's only a couple of minutes. But I like Ed Markey, and you can understand why.
Look, I voted 8 times to honor the victims from 9/11. I mean, these two planes were hijacked at Logan Airport. There were dozens of people from my district who were on those planes. You know, I went to their funerals. I honor those families. I honor them. When they tried to create a Department of Homeland Security, I wanted that Department of Homeland Security to make sure that it never happened again. But when the Republicans brought the bill out and they controlled the House, they put inside of that bill a provision stripping the workers, stripping the first responders from their ability to be able to negotiate for their wages, for their health care collectively. Now, Mr. Gomez supports the Department of Homeland Security that strips the workers of their right to negotiate for their health care, for their pay. All right, I did not. I supported the Department of Homeland Security. He supported the Department of Homeland Security that stripped workers, first responders, of their ability to protect their own families, even as they protect our families.
He gets to respond to that, then I'm going to move on.
I absolutely support the Department of Homeland Security because I care about the security of our country, Congressman. And the bottom line here is you just showed that you put partisanship and party and politics ahead of the people. Ahead of the safety of the people, Massachusetts. And that's also the reason that you didn't vote for the 9/11 resolutions. You put party and politics ahead of what's right for the people of Massachusetts. And that's why I'm running. Because I think this election is about the future, not the past. I think it's about new and fresh ideas versus old and stale. And more importantly, it's because we need to put the people of Massachusetts before party and politics.
Equal time, and then we're moving
because
on.
Our country is
let him in, please.
Our country is much better than its politics.
And by the way, my position ultimately prevailed. I voted no. I thought that these workers, these first responders, should not be stripped of their right to negotiate. And ultimately, that provision was taken out, even though Mr. Gomez supported it. And that is now the law. We have a Department of Homeland Security, but these workers are given the respect which they need. When they rush into the World Trade Center, when they're rushing towards these victims on Boylston Street, no one checks to see whether they're in a union or not. And I don't think that stripping them of their ability to negotiate was a way for us to construct the Department of Homeland Security.
See, I resent more than anything, okay, is the Republican Party using these Gomez's and Rubios and all these illegal aliens, okay, immigrants.
They're not illegal.
Well, they are. They may not be, but they are.
They came here.
They were.
No, they came here legally to this country.
No, they did not.
Yes,
a lot of them did not. And
well,
they became legal through.
You're making a statement that's not true. No, that's not true, Leo. No, that's not true. That's not true.
And I resent.
No, that's not true.
More than you know.
They were legal immigrants.
No, but listen to what I'm saying. What's happening is the GOP is using
You're not expressing yourself correctly.
You know,
expressing yourself correctly. What's happening is they're hiding behind ethnicity.
Yes.
That's what they're doing. It doesn't mean that doesn't mean that a person is an illegal immigrant. What they're doing, they've done it all, and the Democrats have done it with Obama. You're not allowed to criticize him because he's a black man. You can't criticize the Hispanic because they're a minority. That's not right.
But
they hide behind race and ethnicity, you shouldn't be afraid to criticize somebody's
Administration did it behind Condoleezza Rice, and they did it behind Colin Powell. Okay, and they got the most horrendous.
They got a pass on everything they said and did.
We got Obama. Okay,
and he's looking for a pass.
Mr. freaking Teflon, and Holden, who was probably the worst
Attorney General he's ever had. He doesn't look after the rights of the American people.
No,
he has an agenda.
And it's like frightening, but they use this race card, and this race card is absolutely wrong. And I don't care what this union says and what the unions say, okay? The race card is a wrong card to use.
Or
okay?
An ethnic card.
Or ethnic card. Because, you know, these guys are wrong, regardless of their race or their color or their ethnic or their religion.
Well,
Obama
was being criticized recently, the liberal media was saying we were criticizing him because he was black.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with
nothing
why they were criticizing, why people were criticizing. They were criticizing him because he's threatening our constitutional rights.
Right.
That's why they're criticizing him.
The fact that he's black makes no difference whatsoever.
No.
And the fact that he's corrupt and that he's bought by the bankers and that he's a hypocritical, lying son of a bee. Okay, that's what he is. Man, it doesn't matter if he's black, white, or Hispanic, or whatever.
Exactly the same way about Bush. He just
Bush was just a crook.
And he was a white guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
And he had the exact same agenda.
Yep.
Obama has taken that agenda and broadened it.
That's right. And he's gotten away with it because the liberal media has allowed him to do that. Now, you got to say, guys, I've always committed that I was liberal in my leanings. And I still believe that. But at the same time, I do not deny or I do not kowtow, okay, to Mr. Obama, okay, or Mr. Rubio or Mr. Bubio or whatever the hell his name might be, just because they're an ethnic difference, okay? If they don't come across with a solid, make sense
argument,
then I don't care what color they are. They're wrong, okay, and they should be denounced as wrong, regardless of their race or religion
or their position. You have every right to criticize.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, I just get crazy when
we just read the
Connecticut ruling.
Yes, that was on John Rowland, so that's already been done.
Sorry.
So we should go to another site now, I think.
Yeah, I think we've covered 30
a lot of these we've already read. So we'll go to another site.
Okay. We get kind of worked up on these issues because they're so hot. And because I know that they're what they are. And we've been fighting this for years, Lila and I.
to get a little music break while you do this.
Let's be open just a second. But anyway, yeah, let's go do a quick music break and we'll be back.
Too. The Citizens Water Conservation Implementation Task Force filed the report, Water Conservation 2020 Strategic Recommendations. The committee also recommended the city target customers with high water use with an audit campaign to look at outdoor and indoor conservation measures, as well as reducing the city's water use by 2% every year. So what is Agenda 21? Although the buzz terms like sustainable development and smart growth sound friendly enough on the surface, Agenda 21 is a pact the United States signed onto with 177 other countries after the 1992 UN Earth Summit. Agenda 21 describes itself as a comprehensive plan of action to be taken globally, nationally, and locally as a new vision for the 21st century. In short, Agenda 21 is about global control from the ground up. Agenda 21 expert Rosa Kaur sums it up. U.S. Agenda 21 Sustainable Development is the action plan implemented worldwide to inventory and control all land, all water, all minerals, all plants, all animals, all construction, all means of production, all energy, all education, all information, and all human beings in the world. Inventory and control. Though Agenda 21 is technically a non-binding treaty, that didn't stop Bill Clinton from binding America to it with Executive Order 12852 to create the President's Council on Sustainable Development, an official push to align the U.S. environmental policies with UN Agenda 21 directives. Today, it's continued through President Obama's Partnership for Sustainable Communities. For all the ways Agenda 21 will seek to destroy everything from national sovereignty to personal rights, check out this video. Okay. Randomly taking a peek at a recent Austin City Council meeting minutes from the last few months, we can see Agenda 21 at work. Authorized negotiations and executive agreements with Ecobee, Energy Hub, and other thermostat vendors who qualify for participation in Austin's Energy Power Partner Program. Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. So, this is I didn't realize this article was so long.
You can get it at activistpost.com.
It's very, very good.
Yeah.
And
it tells you about it.
It'll probably be coming to a city and town where you live.
It already is. Maybe it already is. And FDA, I hate this guy. I so hate this guy. I can't read any of his stuff. Sorry. Netanyahu says it's anti-Semitism to accuse Israel of war crimes or violating human rights. This is a little long, but it's worth listening to. From Netanyahu.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Jessel Noor in Baltimore. Today, we're going to be discussing the latest developments for the boycott, divest, and sanction campaign coming out of Israel. Joining us today is Shir Hever. He's an economist studying the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories for the Alternative Information Center, a joint Palestinian-Israeli organization dedicated to publishing alternative information and analysis. Thank you for joining us. So, Shir, can you tell us about this major conference that was just held last week in Israel?
This conference was organized by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's called the Global Forum for Combating Antisemitism. It took place between May 28th and May 30th. And this is a very interesting development for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel because the ministry is very concerned about the kind of criticism that is growing around the world regarding Israel, the apartheid system, the abuse of Palestinian human rights, the mass use of violence against innocent civilians. And that is, of course, something that is being manifested also with the boycott movement, the boycott divestment sanction movement, or BDS. And this conference was supposed to be about something else. It was supposed to be about anti-Semitism. Usually the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, at least in the past several years, tried to make it very clear that they don't accuse everyone who criticizes Israel of anti-Semitism, because this sort of argument tends to backfire. Most of the people who express such criticism against Israel on basis of Israel's violations of human rights are people who are defenders of human rights and would also defend the rights of Jews against attacks based on their race or religion. Basically, they're saying that those who criticize Israel, those who accuse Israel of crimes, are in fact anti-Semites. So this is, I think, in many ways, it shows that the Israeli ministry is running out of excuses, running out of ideas. This was a very high-level conference. Many very important speakers were invited. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave the opening speech, and in the speech he said that there are three vilifications, and he listed those three. He said the first one was that Israel is accused of committing war crimes. The second one, Israel is accused of not wanting peace. And the third one, Israel is guilty of violating the human rights of Palestinians. So these three accusations are not vilifications at all. In fact, they are well-documented and well-proven accusations based on international organizations, as well as on many Israeli organizations that say the very same thing. I think most Israelis would actually agree that the Israeli government is not really interested in peace, yet they continue to vote for it. The fact that the Israeli army committed war crimes has been well-established by, for example, the Goldstone Commission, which was actually headed by a Jewish Zionist. The fact that Israel is guilty of violating human rights is even periodically repeated by the U.S. Department of State. It completely undermines the entire meaning of the word anti-Semitic. And that's something very concerning, because there are, of course, still in the world people who hate Jews just for being Jews. There are still anti-Semites. But these anti-Semites are now completely confused and obfuscated with legitimate criticism of Israel. What we see basically is that Israel is so desperate because of the decline of its international legitimacy, because the international media is reporting the crimes committed by Israel, that they are willing to drag with them Jews, wherever they may be, and to allow these Jews to be unprotected from real kinds of anti-Semitism, just so that they could have yet another weapon or another sort of a threat mechanism that they can use against those who would criticize them.
Now, Shir, a lot of the presentations and documents made at this conference have now been made public. What do you think are the most interesting points or arguments coming out of this conference, particularly concerning what Israel is to do about this growing Palestinian solidarity and BDS movement?
If you actually go into the contents of this conference, you see that it's in many ways a very empty conference. There is not that much interesting content in it. An interesting document, although it's interesting mainly because of what it doesn't include, and that is a document about online anti-Semitism, which actually talks about various home pages or Facebook profiles which have anti-Semitic contents in them. Well, I don't think it's very surprising that such things exist on the web, but the fact that it takes such a central place in a conference hosted by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs in a way shows that they really don't have much content to talk about. But when it comes to strategy, when it comes to how they're going to deal and act regarding anti-Semitism, suddenly the target changes, and instead of targeting anti-Semitism, they start to target the BDS movement. The Israeli strategy on dealing with BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, is threefold. It has three layers. One of the layers is about...
Happens whenever we talk about Israeli stuff,
Whenever we do the Israeli thing, we get hacked by our own system. And
not by our own system.
No, by Blog Talk Radio and other things that attack our system. And we got attacked. We just got hacked. So.
But in the meantime, I have an article from the another article
sorry
from
we
the.
Sorry, finish that. That was a very interesting thing. But we just got hacked again, and we've gotten hacked a number of times on this program when we've
mm-hmm.
done this show,
mm-hmm.
and it's not unusual. So I want to acknowledge that we are.
But in the meantime, I have an article from the Activist Post that I'd like you to go to. It's a really long article, but I'll just read the beginning of it. The purpose, and this is by Paul Adams, and what I like about this article, it gives a real explanation.
We must mention, the only reason we're still able to continue is because we have three computers going at the same time. But the one that was broadcasting that particular video got hacked, got zapped, and our entire system got pulled down. But go ahead.
This is on geoengineering and chemtrails. The purpose of geoengineering and chemtrails is death. Virgin alert, throughout May 2013, Southern California, home of 22 million people, received by far the most powerful daily aerosol attacks this writer has ever seen since learning of geoengineering as an issue. The sky remains white out, and mountains 10 miles away are barely visible due to toxic chemtrail fallout. Humanity, as motivated individuals of conscience, must unite and take immediate action to save lives and nature. Everyone must be informed quickly to stop this soft kill murder operation, which is clearly escalating. In earlier times, it was easier to control a million people than physically to kill a million people. Today, it's infinitely easier to kill a million people than to control a million people. That's a quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yes.
National Security Advisor, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, and Bilderberg Group. Geoengineering, often referred to as chemtrails, exists as a global nuisance for the primary purpose of causing severe bodily injury and premature death with malice and aforethought. Geoengineering involves large aircraft constantly spraying the particles of aluminum, barium, amongst many other harmful toxins into the atmosphere and air. All people and animals that inhale these toxins while breathing without informed consent. The toxins also poison the soil and freshwater resources. It is well known and documented that long-term exposure to air pollution consists of particulate matter, significantly increases the risk of dying from lung cancer and heart disease. Over many years, the danger of breathing soot-filled air is comparable to the health risks associated with long-term exposure to secondhand smoke. Excuse me. In 2010 alone, 1,200,000 Chinese were killed by particulate air pollution. The principal dangers of inhaling particulate matter applies to smoke and secondhand smoke, causing lung cancer, coal miners' lung, a lung disease due to inhalation of coal dust, and baker's lung, inhaling flour and other allergens cause severe asthma. These dangers can be avoided while geoengineering particulate fallout cannot. On a massive scale, geoengineering will likely result in democide if not stopped completely. According to Professor R.J. Rummel of the University of Hawaii, democide is the murder of any person or people by a government, including genocide, politicide, and mass murder. Democide does not include soldiers killed in battle. During the 20th century alone, Rommel calculates that government power was used to murder approximately 262 billion people. It appears that history is repeating itself with improved technology. Secondary purposes of geoengineering include controlling the climate or the weather for warfare and profit, and destroying the natural world by furthering the transhumanist synthetic biology agenda. The evidence indicates that geoengineering is an essential element of the elite's endgame move to depopulate the planet. The public must be educated, and the stratospheric spraying stopped immediately. This is a good site to go to, and there is a lot more to this, and they included some pictures as well. But it's a great article.
Yeah, people should know, and we've been promoting this for years, about the aspect of chemtrailing,
mm-hmm.
and for people to know that they're getting zapped every day, you know, every day and every place in the world, as is they're geoengineering the skies, and they're chemtrailing the skies. And there are so many people that have no clue as to the fact that that's happening. They're just looking at it going, oh, I wonder why the sky is so cloudy, or why they're doing those strange things in the sky. Well, they're killing you, folks. That's what it's about. Right? And please, please understand. Because we're running out of tolerance here. You know, there's just so much that you can believe. All right? That you could not believe. And I'm back up. PC is running. And this says that this has happened to my system. And that I was hacked.
Basically to threaten activism, media activists, with some kind of retaliation or action by the Israeli army or the Israeli Mossad. The Israeli military has created a new unit to track BDS activists online and their activities, and the Mossad is also about to become active in tracking activists. And the point of this is to intimidate activists and try to deter them from getting involved, building on the prestige of the Israeli intelligence as very effective and very violent. I don't think it's very likely that the Mossad is going to try to assassinate BDS activists or to directly harm them, because of course this policy will backfire and only make the criticism against Israel more powerful. But they're hoping that just by making the threat, they can deter people from making any criticism whatsoever. And I think it's very interesting that they're making that sort of threat against activists at the same time that their argument is we are going to try to Israel is a democracy. Israel has freedom of speech. Well, it's freedom of speech, but if you criticize Israel, then there's a military unit that's going to track you and follow what you say. What's most interesting about this is that we have all these arguments that are these three arguments that are made by this conference, and we see them all the time in the media. It's called by Israeli speakers Hasbara. Hasbara means explanation. They repeat these three strategies, which are a quantity over quality, changing the subject and talking about technology instead of the occupation, and intimidation, threatening those people who criticize Israel. But there's a fourth one that we don't see. And the fourth one is what we would expect to see, which is Israel trying to argue that their policies are right. We don't see the Israeli government trying to say we have a right to occupy these territories, or Palestinians are actually treated fairly by the Israeli government, because they know this argument doesn't fly. They know that nobody will buy it. The facts are extremely clear against them. And more than anything, this attests to the growth and the strengthening of the BDS movement.
So, Shir, for BDS and Palestinian solidarity activists around the world, what lessons can they take out of this conference?
First of all, the fact that this conference even took place, the fact that the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs is reverting to strategies that they've abandoned because they've proven unuseful. And I think activists should be heartened by this. Second, I would say it's very important for activists not to be intimidated, because, of course, if they allow themselves to be intimidated, if they allow this kind of argument to work, then this is exactly what emboldens the Israeli government to pursue more violent action, not just against Palestinians, but also against international activists. And we should be very clear that this is something that will not deter us. And the third point, and I think maybe the most important point, is that we should not fall into the trap which the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs is trying to lay for us, by which criticizing Israel means criticizing Jews, meaning we should not become anti-Semites. And that is something that is very clearly defined in the BDS movement. And the call for BDS says very clearly we refuse to cooperate with any organization or individual that is racist or anti-Semite. This is not part of the movement, and we refuse to get assistance even from organizations like that. And they're right in doing so. They're very right in doing so, because the Israeli government has shown that it's willing to sacrifice Jews around the world and their safety in the name of protecting Israeli interests. And in our criticism against Israel and Zionism and Israeli policies, we should, of course, not go into that trap that is laid for us, in which we also accuse Jews as if they have some kind of responsibility for them.
Shir Hever, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica, very much.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
There you go, folks. That was the reality of the situation. Jews are being blamed for the Zionist crimes, and that's not necessarily the reason. We're not anti-Semite. We're just anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, and all of their Marxist, Leninist,
Just so that people realize, it is not, you know, people and politicians in America refer to it, they call it a democracy.
It's not
a democracy.
It's a Marxist communist state, and it's an apartheid, and it's extremely prejudiced, and it's a genocidal state, and it has to be stopped. It has to be confronted. It has to be alienated and isolated. And unfortunately, the United States is a stupid, ignorant SOB of a country that just, you know, with its leaders that just do not understand, will not understand, and are somehow Israelis' bitch. And that's the end of the show, and we'll take it from there. So good night, everybody. God bless you, you know, and we were just hacked, which is constantly happening in our program.
No, it doesn't constantly.
No, it's happened several times, and you know it.
But not constantly.
Well, constantly enough. Several times in several weeks is enough. So we thank everybody, and good night.
Good night, folks. Have a good night.